The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast,
I am somewhere between troubled and extremely curious about how this happened.
Remember that arsenic-loving bacterium from last week?
What you're looking at here is an exceptional claim.
We've discovered an organism that can substitute one element for another in these major biomolecules.
Well, it turns out not everyone's been so impressed by that NASA-funded research.
You always need a control to test that what you're seeing is not contamination. The word here is always contamination.
We've assembled a studio of experts to dissect the incredible global reaction.
Somehow, science failed to ask for not even extraordinary evidence, but evidence that other people saw right away.
Plus, we exposed some dating myths just in time for those kisses under the mistletoe.
If you're not dating this much, or if you're not meeting this many people, or if you're not married by this time, or if you haven't got a proposal within this many months, you are doomed. I mean, the lovely thing about using science as opposed to pseudoscience is that science gives you options.
Pucker up, everyone. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. Now, you might remember last week we covered a much-anticipated NASA announcement about some research that, in their words, was an
astrobiology finding that will impact the search for evidence of extraterrestrial life.
We've discovered an organism that can substitute one element for another in these major biomolecules.
But the bottom line out of all this is that what you're looking at here is an exceptional claim.
And what else might we find? What else might we want to look for?
So we remember all this old chemistry, and we don't believe it. And that's what you're going to see a lot of people say.
A bacterium which could incorporate arsenic into its DNA. Or so it seemed. Pretty quickly after the paper was published, criticism began popping up from all corners of the web. Skepticism from bloggers, scientists, and tweeters. As well as critical insights into the science itself, the reaction also threw up some interesting issues about how science is done in the 21st century. Before I introduce you to our assembled experts here in the studio, let's look at some of the early responses to the story.
Even before the announcement, a cryptic press release provoked rumors scientists...
NASA to unveil details of quest for alien life,
said Fox News.
It's life, but not as we know it,
announced The Sun.
Stop freaking out,
cautioned Forbes. On the day of the announcement, The Washington Post reported...
News of the discovery has caused a scientific commotion, including calls to NASA from the White House and Congress asking whether a second line of earthly life has been found.
Once people had the chance to digest the findings over the weekend, the criticism started to flood in. Here's one from microbiologist Rosie Redfield at the University of British Columbia.
The paper doesn't present any convincing evidence that the arsenic has been incorporated into the DNA.
To help us pick through this story, in the studio we've got Zita Martins, a research fellow in the Department of Earth Science and Engineering at Imperial College London. Welcome, Zita. Can we call you an astrobiologist?
Yes, definitely.
That's what we're calling you. We're not calling this bug an alien, though.
No.
You're quite vocal about this. Also here, someone who's been blogging and tweeting aplenty about all of this, David Dobbs, writes for Atlantic Monthly, New York Times Magazine, Slate, National Geographic, Audubon, and the Scientific American Mind, where he's a contributing editor. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You've been quite exercised about this in the past week.
Well, I got exercised first and mainly about the a statement that a NASA spokesperson made.
Mm. Well, we'll come to the NASA response in just a moment, but let's go through the timeline of kind of what happened. So the science paper was published a little while back, and as soon as it hit the newsstands, essentially, there was criticism and started to highlight all sorts of problems with the methodology. So Zita, why don't we just go through what you think? Is the paper a load of rubbish? What went wrong with the science?
Basically, there are a few problems that several scientists spotted. To start with, the medium where they grew the microorganisms, it has phosphate. And that phosphate, scientists realize, may be enough to grow and for bacteria still to survive.
So it would have contaminated the sample.
Exactly. Yeah. So the ideal would be to have a medium without phosphate and just with arsenate and grow the microorganisms just on arsenate. That's not the case. So the phosphate that is still present, it's more than enough for microorganisms to survive and not exchange the arsenate on the backbone of DNA.
Just to remind the listeners, though, the claim in the paper was that this bug, GFAJ1, had incorporated arsenic instead of phosphorus into its DNA. So that was one of the problems.
Yes.
I mean, there were others as well. Mm-hmm.
One of the first critics that we even heard from Stephen Banner on the NASA press conference was that if we had a DNA molecule with arsenate on the backbone instead of phosphate, that molecule would easily hydrolyze. So basically it would be destroyed. And he referred that that molecule would have an off time of 10 minutes. So in a few minutes, that molecule would be immediately destroyed.
So you stick it in water, it just falls apart.
Exactly. And what the main authors of the science paper said is, yeah, that's okay, we recognize that. But while inside of the cell, there might be other molecules that stabilize the DNA molecule with arsenate backbone. So fine, so the trick is to take the DNA molecule out of the cell and to do a series of chemical experiments. What actually the authors did on their science paper is that they took the DNA out of the cell and they actually put it in water because that's one of the steps. And in order to do that, they actually put the DNA in water at least for 1 or 2 hours because it's one of the steps of the experimental procedure. So immediately would be destroyed. So if they still see DNA, which they see, it can't have arsenate on the backbone because no other molecule is there to stabilize the DNA.
Which is mysterious. Now, David,
yes.
What do you make of all of this hype overall in the way that the story's been sort of followed up and covered and been passed around the web? What have you made of this sort of the reaction this past week?
Well, I think one struggle that's going on is who gets to vet science and what constitutes kind of rigorous evaluation of scientific findings. Science has been pretty responsive, the journal, since this whole hubbub in answering questions about how these findings were hyped before the press conference. The hype was done by NASA. They're the one who sent out the press release and organized a very high-profile press conference in which the head of NASA Astrobiology was part. It was a big splash sort of presentation. When the criticism started coming up, they immediately wanted to retreat to this sort of enclave of, no, we should only discuss these things in peer-reviewed journals, not the media.
Well, okay, but on the press conference, they have Stephen Banner there that clearly said, we as scientists, we do not agree with these claims. You still have to prove further. So NASA, in that sense, we have to be fair. They allowed the scientists in there that did not agree with the findings of the paper.
They did. And they seemed to... Which is good that they did that.
Exactly.
My problem began with when they tried to close the doors afterwards and draw a circle of legitimate discussion.
I agree.
That excluded people who should obviously be included in the discussion of how legitimate these findings are. People like Rosie Redfield, who published a critique on her blog that we heard from earlier. And as it happens, lots of other scientists, yourself included, had sharp things to say about this. And as I think we'll hear, Carl Zimmer, another journalist, science journalist, called around and had trouble finding people who could support the paper.
Well, let's listen to Carl. He had some interesting reaction.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, developing
battles. Over the next couple of days, scientists online were getting harsher
in their
comments.
Author, blogger, and science writer Carl Zimmer called his sources to find out more.
And I said, what do you think? And the responses were almost unanimously very harsh.
Carl writes regularly for the New York Times and for Discover, where he's a contributing editor and columnist.
When I got all of these responses, I got in touch with the co-authors of the paper, and I said, would you care to respond? I wanted to give them an opportunity. They refused. And they said that this kind of discourse only belonged in peer-reviewed journals, which is a little ironic given that they had announced their findings at a big press conference that had lots of coverage.
So just for people who don't know how peer review works, Ziza, take us through it. When you've finished a piece of research, what happens next? How do you get it published?
Okay, so basically you submit your article, and then three anonymous independent reviewers will read your paper and say what they think. And then they send comments to the editor and say, well, this is just minor comments, or this scientist really need to do major experiments before this can be published. And so the people that wrote the article should accept that or not, or defend their point of view, send replies to the editor. And this is the way it works until finally everybody is happy with the article and it gets accepted and published.
How major can the criticisms be? Would someone have to redo their experiments?
Yeah, sometimes you get your article rejected because basically the reviewers say, no, your results do not, you cannot conclude a thing from your results. So basically if you say that, then you're in trouble and the article is rejected and you have to start your experiments all over again.
David, is the web providing a sort of post-publication peer review for science now?
It is, and it will, whether the journals or people at NASA like it or not. You can't bottle up Rosie Redfield and silence her. She will speak out. Other scientists will speak out. And there will be a robust, the more robust the better, discussion online about what these findings mean and whether they were derived in a rigorous fashion. That's exactly what's going on. And NASA's stonewalling on this, where they seem to want to cut off discussion and limit it to just the peer-reviewed journals, was part of, expressed a tension that is really strong right now in science, as many people want peer review and evaluation of scientific findings to be opened up so that they take advantage of the tremendous communication powers that the internet holds, rather than be limited to kind of slow motion discussion in peer reviewed journals where everything has to be vetted. And it's historically, it's an interesting retreat, because the whole reason print journals were founded was to open up the discussion of science so that it did not have to occur simply at meetings in London and Paris and Munich and places like this where science was being done. This way other people could read and respond to it. Now it is being used by some people as a place to retreat to. And this varies within the scientific community. Some journals already very successfully open up discussion in the comments below the stories, just the way blogs do, and scientists write in and have substantive, constructive vetting of these of the results. PLOS does that. Nature does that. British Medical Journal or BMJ does it. Lancet, quite a few others as well. So this is not something brand new. It's going to change. It already is changing. And different journals are struggling to try to accommodate it.
Well, I mean, Science, one of the top journals in the world. This is everything in it is supposedly very high quality research, peer reviewed by the best in the field. And the idea is that if you get a science paper or a nature paper, that, you know, it's a real big thing for a scientist. This, do you find it? I mean, this is a question for both of you, really. Do you find it surprising that Carl Zimmer found 13 scientists within 2 days to offer such withering critiques of the paper, given that this had been peer reviewed and it had gone through the process?
Let's see it from the science point of view. The editor had 3 reviews. Maybe those people raised comments, but the editor thought they were not very significant. And that's it. The article published like any other article in the field. I mean, this happens lots of times. Articles get published, then scientists don't agree. They raise questions. They send other articles again and say, we don't agree. Then the first authors reply and say, well, our point of view is this and this and this. What happened this week is that the media also got involved. So, and because we have the internet and everything, things got really hyped to start with. And things got out of hand, and things are happening really, really fast, which normally they don't.
I am somewhere between troubled and extremely curious about how this happened, because quite a few of the people who have complained about the paper, the scientists, have said that there are fairly easy steps you can take to be very certain about whether this bug incorporated arsenic into its DNA. Zita can speak to those specifics better than I. But to me, the very fact that quite a few people said there are simple tests you can do that take a reasonable amount of time that could prove or disprove this assertion, and that that was not raised during peer review or not insisted on in peer review, I find that troubling. I don't know what went on with the peer review. I don't know how many reviewers they used or who they were. That information is closed off. But it does trouble me that Science had the paper for 6 or 8 weeks, and Carl, in 48 hours, could find 13 people who did ask those questions.
Zita, the experiments that David's mentioning are the ones you talked about before, sticking it in water, see if it falls apart. Mm-hmm. That's as simple as that.
It is as simple as that, but I mean, the main thing is to have control. So in every experiment we do, you always have to see if your data is really what you're seeing, meaning it's not just contamination. So that's one of the things, better controls, and you always need to do that. And then the main experiment is really to have a mass spectrum of the DNA sequence. It's fairly simple experiment, and that's the ultimate proof.
They didn't do that either?
No.
And that would be absolutely definitive one way or another?
Yes, and they can still do that. I mean, that's how science evolves. If they can take over the comments, and if they can do that and show that, fine. We're all happy as a scientist. If they can't, then something is wrong.
I would hope that someone would be doing that, and I guess what troubles me is it wasn't done before, precisely because this is an extraordinary claim. And as Carl Sagan once said, and people are fond of quoting him, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Exactly.
It seems that somehow science failed to ask for not even extraordinary evidence, but evidence that other people saw right away would help answer the question. There may be a good explanation for why that didn't happen, but I'd love to hear it.
Well, now you might think that NASA might be a bit embarrassed about some of this stuff, but the Venerable Space Agency, as David said, initially dismissed the criticisms because the critics were on blogs. Eventually, though, a sort of response came from the authors.
Wednesday, 6:38 p.m. Felisa Wolf-Simon posts a short response to her critics on her website.
My research team and I are aware that our peer-reviewed science article has generated some technical questions and challenges from within the scientific community. Our manuscript was thoroughly reviewed and accepted for publication by Science. It's our understanding that Science is in the process of making our article freely available to the public for the next 2 weeks to ensure that all researchers have full access to the findings. We invite others to read the paper and submit any responses to Science for review so that we can officially respond.
Now, one of those people who actually is writing a letter to Science as we speak is Rosie Redfield, the first scientist who raised the issues in the weekend after the paper was published. But David, that response on Felisa Wolf-Simon's website, a lot of her points still speak to that issue of put it through the journals. This is how we do science. Don't send me emails and blog posts. You've got to publish something in Science. And this is how it's going to happen. And what happens next? Do people send letters to her or to Science? What happens next to try and repeat the experiments?
Well, that is the standard procedure at the journals, of course, is for people to write them letters or technical comments, which there's a distinction there that we don't need to go into now. But there will be a decision at Science which and how many of those to run, which might or might not satisfy the critics in terms of whether the main critiques have been aired. I think every science writer who has done this work for a while knows of cases that they were told about off the record, and so they can't discuss, as I can't discuss now, but knows of cases where corrections to articles were sent in and never printed for whatever reason. So it's easy to understand why some people would have less than complete faith in that peer-reviewed system robustly and completely evaluating this thing and vetting and filtering and coming to good conclusions about these findings.
If you look carefully to the science paper, there is no reference whatsoever to ET life. And I think all this ET life started really with a press release from NASA where they said, we discovered something that has implications for future extraterrestrial detection.
That's right. And as soon as you put head of astrobiology in a room and with the announcement afterwards, major discovery to be announced by NASA, the people who probably would discover life out there in the universe if anyone's going to do it. I mean, what did they expect from all of us?
Yeah, as I said in one of my blog posts, I think you could put that press release out. You could do that experiment 40 times and you would get the same sort of hype every time. I think it's kind of disingenuous to say, oh, some media ran away with this story. We never said we, you know, found alien life. You're begging for this result, and you shouldn't be surprised when you get it. I mean, it's not a very empirical thing to be surprised about something that predictable.
Zita, one of the reasons that the NASA spokesperson said that they weren't going to respond was because some of the criticisms were on blogs. You're a scientist. Is that a fair thing to sort of ignore? Would you ignore blogs if they were criticizing your work?
No, definitely not, especially because it was a scientist that raised the main question. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If it wasn't, I mean, you have to be careful, but he was a scientist, so
and you have to engage. I mean, this is
you should engage, and that's
science is.
Yeah, and that's one of the things. Science journal openly says you should reply to the comments of the journalists. I mean, every time you have a press release as a scientist, and whenever the journalists get back to you, you answer the questions. So it's not a problem. Obviously, you're not going to answer in specific and scientific details, but you reply to their questions, and in this case. Let's face it, I mean, Rosie Redfield is a scientist, so...
And so, just on the larger point then, this is the kind of stuff that happens in seminar rooms and conferences amongst scientists all the time.
Every time you
this
go to a...
This shouldn't be surprising.
No, for us as a scientist, it's not surprising at all. The surprising thing here is that it got to the main public. So it's a good thing. So the public is seeing really how science evolves and the type of discussion we have. And just because somebody published in a high-ranked journal as Science and Nature, it doesn't mean as we as scientists accept immediately the claims.
David, is this good for science? Wouldn't it be nicer if it was just all neat and we sort of told the stories that we tell because they popped out of journals one by one without any question?
It would be a lovely fantasy world to live in. I think the beauty of this is politically a fairly inconsequential scientific argument. It's important for people doing the work, but in the realm of things compared to something like climate, this is... pretty cool issue politically. So I think it's good that people see that science is generally like this. People argue over how the findings are and the work behind it, and they ask for more proof. It's messy. It's like democracy. It's messy. It's not a clean, neat thing on which everyone agrees. And for people to know that that's how science is done all the time, that's healthy, because then when you see a little bit of the backroom messiness behind something like climate science, you don't think that's unusual and it's a result of political pressures and, you know, really unusual conflicts of interest. I mean, there's a couple of things worth noting here. First, NASA claimed, at least this one fellow who said he doesn't want this debated in blogs. It's worth pointing out that NASA has quite a few blogs of its own. Someone tweeted that they had 40. I did not check this fact, but and they are also quite willing to talk about science in the press as long as the science gets discussed in ways that flatter them. But there's this impulse. And this, when I blogged about this, I got a lot of reactions on Twitter and in emails and so on saying, well, you can't just open this process to everyone or there'll be a rabble. You'll spend all your time arguing with anti-science people and so on. Well, you're trying to have a spam filter here, right? You're trying to draw a circle in which trolls can't come in and dominate the conversation. I guess to an extent that makes sense, but you don't want to draw a circle that boxes out legitimate scientists like Rosie Redfield. So the circle that this fellow from NASA proposed is simply not sustainable. It's not healthy. And if you want a nice, quiet conversation, the way the fellow from NASA said he wanted, then you should start the conversation quietly and not by holding a big, high-profile press conference.
I think that's the main point. I mean, usually when we as scientists publish an article, and if the results are amazing, we have a press release, but that's it. We don't have a press conference. So if Just the fact that NASA had this massive press conference and everybody was wondering what are the results and everything. I mean that was the main problem to start with.
Can I raise some human issues here? I mean, whether there are science is done by people who need funding, who have careers. Some people in the blogosphere are arguing that NASA did this press conference in this big way because they're about to have their funding cut. They want more money, and this is a really nice flashy announcement that they could give to Congress, who would say, wow, you guys are amazing, you have more money. There are other people saying that, for example, that the scientists involved in the research had something to prove, that they wanted to find bacteria that lived on arsenic. Paul Davis, one of the authors, and Felisa Wolf-Simon's mentor in some ways, has said that this would be an important step to finding life elsewhere, hypothetically. These things must have influenced all of this circus.
I think it's inevitable that these things have influences. People are influenced by all kinds of things. They're influenced by things they want to find out. They're engaged in a whole field that they simply like doing the work. The question is, can you do your work if you have something you're sort of eager to prove? The ideal, of course, is that you're not trying to prove something. You are trying to test a question. But all the time, scientists are hoping to prove one view of things. The critical thing is, even if you are hoping to prove something, that you do your work in a way that would be indistinguishable from someone who simply wants to test the hypothesis. That's what keeps you from being caught out and accused of failing to test the thing rigorously. I don't want to say what the author's motivations were or if they fell prey to this temptation, but many people are saying that they failed to do fairly easy tests that would test the question rather than prove the thing. Some scientists have actually said, you don't simply do the tests that will support your evidence. You do the tests that can disprove them, and you have not done them. But these are the things that come up, and yes, science is a very human endeavor. People are driven by all kinds of passions. People are ambitious. That's why they do often very interesting, bold, ambitious science. But again, if you're going to do that kind of science, you need to take extra effort to cover your backside. And it's a little troubling that so many people think they didn't do that in this case.
I think that's a problem. Sometimes the passion is so big and you get so wrapped up with your research that you lose focus. And it's always important to hear other scientists, even if they don't agree with your opinion. And because they give you good advice. They say, okay, you're just seeing from this point of view, just do this and experiment.
One interesting story I came across that came to mind last week was the discovery by Thomas Huxley, who is known as Darwin's bulldog, mm-hmm. of some stuff that was growing on the seafloor, Bathybius. He called it, and he thought he had discovered the primordial ooze from which all life evolved. It was stuff that kind of he found in a test tube of seawater that he'd taken up from the sea bottom. And he spun this beautiful story about it, how this was the origin of life, and it got a lot of publicity. And then someone went home and they cleaned their tubes properly, and they did a test, and they figured out that no, this ooze was just some gunk that grew because the containers he put the seawater in still had a residue of a cleanser. So it was just a complete artifact.
Then we returned to the controls again.
He had screwed up and not done his controls. And when this came out, he wrote, I wish I could remember it to quote it, but an extremely amusing letter to Nature, I believe it was, you know, conceding the point, kind of humbly, which didn't necessarily come easily to Thomas Huxley, humbly conceding defeat and, you know, my bad. I'm not saying that this happened in this case, but it certainly sprang to mind, and it shows how someone's desire to see something can color their technique. That happened to Huxley. It happens all the time.
Okay. Let's finish by talking about some positive things about astrobiology. Zita, this is your field. What is it that we should be looking out for in this field? I mean, it's a young science. What is the stuff that, you know, is really getting you guys excited?
Okay, so there are two main questions in the field of astrobiology that we're trying to answer. The first one is, how did life start here on Earth? That's crucial. The second one is, are we alone in the universe or not? And so those are exciting things. And recently, the Royal Society had a survey where they asked the British public about what are the main scientific areas that you think are the most important ones. And they found that nearly half of the British population thought that they believe in these existence of aliens, and a third of it thought that scientists should be really looking for ET life and everything. So let's face it, this is not just on the scientific community. General public...
No, this is sexy stuff.
Exactly. I mean, the general public thinks this is amazing, and I love the field of astrobiology.
How close are you to answering either of those questions?
I think that we still have a long way to go, to be honest. I mean, we have a few space missions to Mars in the next, let's put it like this, 10 years, if things don't get delayed again. And I think that will get us a step closer to finally answering the question, is there life on Mars or not? And that's, I think, it will, if we find something, it will change lots of things in the society. I always compare this to the way of that 400 years ago, we changed our position in the universe. I mean, right now, we know that the sun is in the center, but 400 years ago, it wasn't the case. We thought that the Earth was in the center, and when we found out it wasn't like that, lots of things change. Religion change. From the social point of view, things change. So I think if we find extraterrestrial life, then it will be amazing, and it will have huge implications in the society.
Just to, if anyone's interested in listening to more of those implications, I mean, it's well worth listening to the interview we did with Paul Davis a few months ago, where he goes into the implications of philosophy and religion about finding extraterrestrial life. It's fascinating stuff. Okay, well, we'll leave all of that stuff there. Go and check out our continuing coverage of this study on our story tracker. You'll find that at guardian.co.uk/science. There's a link to that on our Facebook group. Search for The Guardian's Science Weekly podcast. Next, the science of pulling.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Now, just a little something to lighten the mood.
My tender heart.
Some reassuring words for anyone looking for love right now.
I'm Petra Boynton. I'm a social psychologist, and I'm also a sex educator and agony aunt. And my research is around sex and relationships, but I have a special interest in understanding how we provide dating advice, particularly through the media. There's four key areas I'm going to bust some myths on, and the first one is the idea that being single is abnormal. The actual evidence shows, mainly coming from research by Ed Laumann and colleagues in Chicago, that you could expect to be single for at least a third of your life, if not more. For a lot of people, that's quite a heartening statistic, because they actually think, my goodness, you know, being on my own is abnormal or wrong. Was actually, you know, the average is that you should expect to be, you know, expecting to being single is an important part of life. The other thing I'll be looking at is the average age that people in the West get married, because again, a lot of people are very anxious that they are past it at 22 and are never going to meet anybody. Now, if you look at the UK General Household Survey, the average age for men to get married is 34, and the average age for women is 29. So that's actually quite high if you think about what a lot of people are worrying about. So the hope there is to reassure people that they haven't got to stop panicking, that because they're 21 and they haven't got a partner, that they're never going to get married at all. The other thing I'm going to look at is the idea of online dating. because a lot of online dating sites pride themselves on how many successful matches they make, how many couples they get together. And I'll be asking people how much of a chance they think they have of actually meeting somebody and going on a date with them in a 1 month period from joining a dating site. And interestingly, if you look at the research coming out of the dating websites themselves, it's only about a 1 in 10 chance of finding somebody and going on a date with them if you're doing internet dating. Now, that doesn't mean to say you should rule out internet dating, but it's just interesting given that they rely so heavily on science and maths about this sort of opportunity you'll get by doing that method, and often claiming it's very scientific, as in they're going to profile you and match you and get you somebody, that actually it's probably not going to be that much higher than if you were trying other methods. And the other big myth, I think, is to get people to think about one-night stands, because the general cultural view is that these are bad things that never go anywhere, or you can do them but you mustn't expect too much of them and they won't lead to a longer term relationship. But some research has actually just come out from some sociologists. Anthony Pike surveyed about 600 couples and looked at how they got together in the first place and how happy they were now, and there's no difference in terms of how long a relationship lasts and how happy it is based on whether they slept together on the first date or waited a seemly interval until they slept together.
Yes.
I think a lot of the point of using these sort of received science facts that I think people expect is to say, look, actually, a lot of this stuff is not what you think, and it doesn't even matter, really, because even if there's an average, there has to be a range, and it's fine to fit within a range of behaviours as well. So it's giving people the confidence to actually use science to empower them, as opposed to be tied down by these sort of, I think, tyrannical messages you often get in self-help books about, you know, if you're not dating this much, or if you're not meeting this many people, or if you're not married by this time, or you haven't got a proposal within this many months, you are doomed. The lovely thing about using science as opposed to pseudoscience is that science gives you options.
And a quick thank you there to producer Andy for allowing us to use that recording of his recent therapy session.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
That's it, the last of our studio-based podcasts for this year. Next week, they're going to let me out of the office to bring you a programme recorded on set at the Royal Institution ahead of its world-famous Christmas lectures.
This chili comes from Bangladesh originally, but we're now going to test its effects.
Also, here's a little treat, a sneak preview of our Christmas special for the week after next, the 27th of December.
What's the Wi-Fi access like around where the internet was invented?
Terrible. It's absolutely awful. That's the worst thing of all. Yeah, so we have our own kind of amplifier in our office and it regularly crashes, so you have to go and turn it off and on again, as with most of these things. But yeah, I can officially say it's crap.
Okay, stop that there. We've probably said too much already. But if you want to know more, there are top secret details about it on our Inside Guardian blog. There's a link to that on our page at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. It's probably also on WikiLeaks somewhere if you look.
This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth.
I'm Alok Jha.
Thanks for listening.
Are we allowed to call it an alien bacteria?
No.
No.
We're just going to call it the monolake bug,
okay.
In deference to David over there.
I just wanted to record your reactions to that. That was fine.
Okay. Oh, dear. I see what he's doing. Some reassuring words for anyone looking for love right now.
Just a bit sexier, that last line, please.
What?
Just a bit.
You're going to use this. I don't want this in the outtakes. Some reassuring words for anyone looking for love right now.
You're right, I am going to use that one now. Brilliant, and then just whisper this next bit.
She's a lecturer in International Health Services Research at University College London.
And again, sexier and whisperier.
She's a lecturer in International Health Services Research at University College London.
Oh yeah, okay. And then you can slag me off.
This is Alan's deep bath territory, isn't it?
So you submit your journal to a big or not so big newspaper, and can
nope,
we do this
again?
So,
submit your article. You can submit to a newspaper if you like. Just imagine.
And then it's rigorously vetted.
and then the blogosphere gets hold of it, and all sorts of crazy things happen.
Sorry, guys. Okay,
let's start again.
Exactly.
It's like those spies who are like, don't have to torture someone. So just tell me again what were you doing?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's right. Anyway, right. Okay. Ask the question again.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.